The Random House Unabridged Dictionary defines Catch-22 as a frustrating situation in which one is trapped by contradictory regulations or conditions. The expression was coined by Joseph Heller as the name for the ultimate, most absurd military regulation. Heller titled his first novel Catch-22. It was set during World War II and published in 1961. It found its most enthusiastic audience during the Vietnam War, when readers related to the novel's black humor. Heller's subsequent novels include Something Happened, Good as Gold, and God Knows. In 1981, Heller was struck with Guillain-Barré syndrome. This is a virus which attacks the nervous system and paralyzes the body. Heller recovered from the paralysis, although some of his muscles never regained full strength. His recent book, No Laughing Matter, described that period of his life when he was physically helpless. This week, Joseph Heller is a visiting writer at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. He visited our studios earlier today. I asked him about the expression Catch-22.
I don't know where it comes from. I did not begin with that. In writing the first chapter, which was about 8 or 10 pages, I saw an opportunity to put in something, a catch. It comes from the phrase, there's always a catch to something, or there's just one catch. I decided on impulse to give it a number, so it would have the power of an official statute. I didn't know whether I would keep it or not keep it. Then in contemplating the second chapter and future chapters, I saw other occasions when that could be employed and to become a kind of mysterious philosophy, perhaps explaining events, but if not explaining anything, justifying any type of illegitimate action and converting it to legitimate actions.
I'm sorry.
The number itself was of no significance to me, and for the 7 years I worked on it, it was called Catch 18. And then because Leon Uris was going to publish a novel called Mila 18, and Leon Uris was very famous and I was not, the publishers decided I better get a new title. And it was an editor who called me up one day and suggested, I think I have a number that's better than 18. He said 22, and I said, you're right. And it's better because it does reflect the repetition of dire events which occur throughout the book.
Why did you make it the catch that you did? In other words, the catch being that in order to get out of...
Well, that's just one use of Catch-22. Yeah. The one that's most frequently quoted is that a bombardier doesn't have... A man doesn't have to go into combat if he's crazy, but as soon as he expresses a wish to get out of combat, that's proof of insanity. That's just one. To me, the more frightening one occurs toward the end, when MPs have come in and broken up a house and arrested people and an old woman is left, and when Yossari asks them, how did they do it? Why were they allowed to do it? She says, Catch-22. And he said, did they read it to you? He says, no, they don't have to read it to me. And, of course, Catch-22 says they don't have to tell you what Catch-22 is about. And then comes the more dire line that says, Catch-22 says they can do anything to us we can't stop them from doing.
The absurdity of war was an idea really more associated with the Vietnam War than it was with World War II, the war that you were in and the war that Catch-22 is set in. Did you experience it as an absurd war when you were fighting?
No, actually, in talking to students, I have to make a point of stating that Catch-22 was not autobiographical in the sense that the experiences, the emotions and attitudes of Yossari and other sympathetic characters were not my own at the time I was in World War II, and probably were not those of most people in World War II, because there was a uniformity of opinion, a sense of rightness and necessity about fighting World War II, which has not existed since and which has rarely existed in the past in American history. My impression, I was very young, as most Americans were in World War II, 19 or 20, so my impression might be misleading, but there was a sense of governmental efficiency. It might have been inefficient, but it was never silly and never as inhumanly corrupt or devious as the wars or the politics, political statements about the wars have been ever since.
You were a bomber pilot.
I was a bombardier, not a pilot.
Oh, okay.
A bombardier in the B-25s, which were medium bombers. I was overseas at a time when it was very safe, relatively safe for me. When I left, it became dangerous again, and before I got there, it had been dangerous. But I was a bombardier in the B-25.
Did your attitude toward being a bombardier and toward being in the military change as you got deeper into the war?
No, it changed in terms of my own personal experience. I was required to fly 60 missions, and most were relatively easy. In fact, if I went on what was called the milk run at the beginning, I was disappointed. The only thing I knew about war was an impression obtained from Hollywood motion pictures. And if nothing happened, I was disappointed. I wanted adventure. Late in my tour of duty on my 37th mission, I had some adventure. I saw a plane shot down and a man on my plane was wounded. And for the next 27 missions, I was in a state of consternation, which often approached terror.
So but
that did not involve questioning the necessity of that war or fighting that war.
You know, it's interesting to me. A lot of writers write a great war novel during their career. And something about war is that fighting in it gives you kind of great material if you're a writer. On the other hand, half of your generation is experiencing it at the same time. So you have all these other writers writing great novels about war. Was that ever a problem for you, knowing that you might have this great novel about war in you?
No, I didn't. It was not a problem. If anything, the very good, I hesitate to use the word great about any novel, including my own, but the very good and successful war novels were an inspiration for me and a deterrent. Now, we're thinking...
A deterrent?
Well, a deterrent in this way, that Norman Mailer had written The Naked and the Dead almost 10 years before I began Catch-22, and James Jones in 1950 or 51 published the From Here to Eternity. Deterrent in this respect, that I was not going to write a realistic book about World War II because my own experiences were limited. I really don't like doing research. And they, each of them and others... had already done very well what they had done. There was no need for another novel that would duplicate those. So it was a guide to me, and I was seeking a... once I decided to write a novel, I didn't decide to write a novel until I was 30 years old, then the task came of what novel to write. And my major experience then was in World War II, so it would be set in World War II. But the fact that these other writers had done their work so well led me to seek an area in which a novel could be written that had not been, a kind of novel that had not been written, and that was Catch-22, which was inspired more by the post-World War, the attitudes of the post-World War, than by the actual situation of World War II or my own experiences in it.
Writer Joseph Heller is my guest. Catch-22 is your first novel. And it took you several years till your next novel was published. Did you go through a period of thinking, uh-oh, say I never complete the next novel?
No.
Were you ever scared about that?
Nope, not at all. Catch-22's success was modest and very slow in accumulating a reputation. My second novel, Something Happened, was very slow in being completed. It was very much different from Catch-22, in many ways a dangerously experimental novel because... unlike Catch-22, which is filled with action, violence, and comedy, violent comedy, Something Happened is borders on a monotonous situation. And the challenge I had with that and enjoyed was writing a novel that was very deep psychologically, in which the dramatic elements are muted and yet keep the novel interesting. It was the growing reputation of Catch-22 that gave me the confidence to this extent, the knowledge that whether the book succeeded or failed, it would get a lot of attention from critics and reviewers and would be read very carefully. And Something Happened as a book that should be read carefully. So Catch-22 was never frightening to me.
I want to ask you about another novel, Good as Gold, which starts off with a college professor who's asked to write a novel, to write a study of the Jewish experience in America. And I wonder if you had ever been approached to write such a book yourself.
Well, the idea for that book came from a question from a woman in Wilmington, Delaware. I was there talking to them and reading to them pretty much the way I'm here at the University of Pennsylvania talking about my works and answering questions or inviting questions. And a woman asked me, why is it you've never written about the Jewish experience in America? And I gave my answer, which is truthful but too long to go into here. And then coming back from Delaware on the train, I began thinking about the question. I was nothing else I wanted to write. And by the time I got off the train, I had the idea for Good as Gold, which begins with my protagonist, Bruce Gold, had been asked many times to write about the Jewish experience, most recently by a woman in Wilmington, Delaware.
It seems to me this was, in a way, a backdoor way for you to write a little bit about the Jewish experience in America without having to write about the Jewish experience in America.
Well, it also coincides with my own experience, because my answer to her was that I didn't feel I was qualified, because my Jewish experience was very much different from my parents and very much different from Bernard Malamud and Philip Roth and certainly Isaac Singer and others whose names came to me more readily than they do now.
You mean you didn't feel like you had an official Jewish experience?
Exactly, yes, because I grew up in a neighborhood in which everyone was Jewish. Then I moved into the army where everyone was not Jewish, and that was a kind of revelation. Growing up as a child, you begin to think everybody is Jewish, and all parents speak with a Yiddish accent. And after World War II, at least where I lived, which is New York City, and on a collegiate level, anti-Semitism decreased. It was no longer fashionable. And no longer fashionable, also no longer normally vicious. The fact that certain clubs exclude people, that's easily tolerated by me.
Well, you weren't going to be members of those clubs
anyway. I do feel, without being anti-feminist, I'm not. I do feel that private groups should have the right to select who they want to. And I think the law in most places do allow them to do that if they don't get tax benefits. But we're moving away. My Jewish experience was largely an American experience, and not much different in that area from almost everybody I knew. So what occurred to me was, well, maybe a novel ought to be written or can be written about somebody of my approximate age who was growing up, who grew up in a Jewish neighborhood, and after the war was found that his Jewish experience was very largely a metropolitan experience and an American experience. And that's what Good as Gold came to. Now, going beyond that, it was being written in an age when Jews were being accepted. They're still not accepted in certain industries in banking, but were being accepted in government in a high position. A blessing to me was the prominence at that time of Henry Kissinger. So I made very much of him in the book and the effect upon the character.
You know, I want to ask you, since we're talking about the time when you were growing up, you grew up in Coney Island,
yes,
which is most famous for its huge amusement park, which is kind of past its glory days now. I assume it's still open. I haven't been back there in a long
time. Oh, it's open. But see, what most of the world doesn't know, it's also a very large residential area and has been. I was a mile away from the amusement area, but there was a very large, I don't know what the population figures were, but there was a very large residential Italian population in one part, and the other part was almost entirely Jewish. I mean, there must have been 25,000 or 40,000 or 50,000 families living there and regarded as a neighborhood which had the advantages. Now, it was a low-income neighborhood then, but which had these very precious advantages of a beach, a boardwalk close by, which is most valuable in the spring and autumn and sometimes in the winter, and had this fantastic amusement park there.
Did you have this feeling that, well, most kids have the parachute jump within walking distance?
The parachute jump came late in my experience. Native Coney Islanders always looked on that with disdain as being there mainly for tourists.
It was
not a particularly exciting ride. I grew up at a time when there were large amusement parks. Luna Park was one and Steeplechase was another. But they were there. The rites of passage involved growing up, the time you went on the highest roller coaster, which was called the Mile Sky Chase, and then you went on the most thrilling, which was the Cyclone. And after a while, you're swimming out a quarter of a mile or half a mile to the bellboy there. That's the way we grew up. In certain rides, we began disdaining it in early years. Just the way if you wanted a hot dog, you went to Nathan's. You didn't go to Feldman's because Feldman's was German, and it didn't have garlic in it. It wasn't smoked.
Do you ever go back to your old neighborhood?
Occasionally. I don't live in New York City now. I live about 2.5 hours away. I go back when a foreign interviewer comes and wants to see where I grew up, so we go there.
Right. I'm speaking with writer Joseph Heller, whose books include Catch-22, Something Happened, Good as Gold, and No Laughing Matter. We're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Joseph Heller is my guest. The one book of nonfiction that you've written that I know of is No Laughing Matter, which is a very personal account of the period that you had Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is something that was responsible for a rather long period of temporary paralysis. Would you just describe a little bit what Guillain-Barré is?
Well, Guillain-Barré is a disease of what's called the peripheral nervous system, which I now know constitutes those nerves which come out of the spinal cord and out of the brain. The tissues are inflamed. As they get inflamed, the nerve responses are diffused, and the muscles become weak. The muscles become weak because they're not being activated. And it leads, in its most extreme cases, to total paralysis, where the person cannot even close the eyelids, and is incapable of talking, and is on a respirator. Mine was a moderate case. There is no known cause for it, although it's often stimulated by a viral infection, although the virus doesn't cause it, which means it often follows inoculations. I did not have inoculations. It was kind of amusing in onset because I did not have any sensory disturbances. Many people get numbness and tingling and then burning sensations. So I was paralyzed and needed care for about, I was in the hospital, two hospitals for close to 6 months, and then it was about another 6 months before I could take care of myself. I left the hospital in the wheelchair and needed my friend Speed Vogel to take care of me, and I hired the most charming of the private nurses I have to take care of me, and we're married now because that worked out beautifully for us. It's a very serious disease, a very expensive disease, and many people do not recover to the extent that I have. And because I was knew I was recovering, and because I was never in pain, and the idea came, I wanted to keep Speed Vogel with me through that winter. And a friend of his suggested, why doesn't he write a book about taking care of me? And he asked me, could he do it? And I said, no, but I think together we can do it. So we wrote alternate chapters of it.
Can I ask you, when you started getting certain symptoms, knowing that something was wrong, the food tasted funny and you had trouble swallowing, had you ever had hypochondriac problems before that, where you could have confused
fear?
At all.
No, a fear of disease and a fear of death I've always had, and it's prevalent in all my books, even in the most comical of my books, which I suppose would be good as gold. I've never had a hypochondriac. I've never imagined I've had something, and I'm very slow to go to doctors. And when I go to a doctor, I notice something specific. And I delayed with this for 2 days because most symptoms I get past, most symptoms most people get. But it reached a point where I unmistakably knew my shoulders were getting weak and the difficulty in swallowing was increasing. And even at that time, I was jogging regularly. But I noticed in the warm-up exercises, they were getting more and more difficult. So I called the doctor with some amusement, and I knew something was going on inside. I mean, it was something I'd never experienced before. And it was exciting. I felt kind of whimsical about it because there was no fever, no pain of any kind.
You know, in your book, you
and incidentally, I've corresponded or heard from hundreds of people who've
who
had
haven't.
This disease. Mine guessed at the right diagnosis over the telephone, which astounds many people. Because sometimes it takes a week. And along with this, many people that I've heard from are usually sent to a psychiatrist because it's something which cannot be verified clinically.
Huh. So they think it's a hypochondriac kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. They think it's some form of hysteria, hysteria in a psychiatric sense.
You know, you describe lying in bed in the hospital and having your friends coming to visit you. One of those friends was Mel Brooks.
Right.
And he basically wanted to know, contagious, or would he get it?
Well, Mel is, I've known Mel a long time. Mel is acutely, he's not a hypochondriac either, but he is acutely alert to the possibilities of diseases of all kinds, and does really have medical dictionaries, and I believe, in truth, does subscribe to the New England Journal of Medicine and to Lancet, which is the English publication. So his first visit to me, really, he knew more about it than I did then, but I knew enough to know he knew a great deal about it.
Were you offended with him coming in and basically wanting to quiz you to see?
Not at all. Not at all. He was also coming to
I realize that. I realize that.
He's coming as a friend.
Okay. you were initially in the intensive care unit.
Yeah.
Usually when someone's in intensive care, their mind is really dulled. And they're barely conscious. You're one of the few people who had all your wits about you. It was just your body couldn't move.
It is one of the characteristics of this disease that the mind is unimpaired. So in that unit, there were three other beds. And for the 22 days I was there, I'd say for 19, I was the only one with whom the nurses could speak, the only one who was conscious. And it was not a blessing because every other day somebody next to me, of course, would die. There's a man I'm in touch with who was totally paralyzed, meaning he could not speak.
Yeah.
And his description of how the medical personnel would forget that he could hear and reason, and some of the things he observed and the things nurses would talk about, sexual experience, doctors making jocular or sexual advances to nurses, and people talking about what they did the day before in his presence. He described that as among the most humiliating experience of his life, the fact that he was lying there hearing everything and being completely cogent. This struck me while I was in the middle of writing God Knows. And sometimes half in jest, sometimes not so much in jest, people would ask me if I thought God was giving me a warning about God Knows, not to continue writing it. My answer is no, because there are other people around me who are more severely ill, and in a rehabilitation hospital of the 60 patients on my floor, I was the only one who had a chance of recovering enough to resume a normal life.
You've fully recovered from
No, I've recovered as much as I'm going to. I have numerous muscular weaknesses, mm-hmm. including pronouncing certain sounds because my mouth was affected and I have trouble certain vowels and consonants which require a pursing of the lips. I have to make with a muscular effort. Shoulders are weak, legs are weak, but that weakness does not bother me in the slightest.
I hope this isn't too personal, so if it is, we'll drop it. But I know you married the woman who was your nurse.
Yeah.
Did you have to redefine your relationship after you got well and it was no longer a professional relationship?
I had been married a very long time to my first wife. We had been separated for years. First time in my life I lived alone was resolved that I would never marry again because of my I didn't want to take the trouble learning how to live with somebody. Now, what happened, fortunately for me and Valerie, is that we were together day and night for close to a year. So by that time, the nurse-patient relationship changed very, very gradually, and I knew her very well, and she knew me intimately as a result of taking care of me. No, it didn't change at all.
One of the things you're famous for is your sense of humor in your writing. Do you feel that having had a protracted illness has affected your sense of humor at all?
Not in the least, no.
Do you think it's heightened it?
No, it doesn't affect my humor. It's given me a much healthier attitude toward life. It takes a lot more to get me angry or to make me impatient than it did before. And I'm leading a glorious life now because God Knows was finished. Now, I ran out of money while I was sick. It's a very, very expensive illness because it requires a long period of care in a rehabilitation hospital. But when... Luckily, my hands came back first. I was able to resume writing. When God Knows was completed and the publisher liked it, accepted for publication, from that time on, I'm living a more relaxed, happy life than ever. I do only what I want to do in a way of work, which is to write.
Yeah, have you changed the balance of work to leisure in your life?
No, my leisure is my work.
Uh-huh.
I'm fortunate that I have no interest in athletics and watching it or playing it. I'm bored stiff, as bored by the Olympic Games as I am by the presidential campaigning. What my pleasure is writing, and so in that respect, I'm extremely fortunate.
When your new novel, Picture This, is published in August, it will be the second novel of yours to be published since you got sick. Are you writing quicker now than you used to?
I'm writing quicker because there are fewer distractions. I don't live in Manhattan anymore. I live in East Hampton, which is the country, and live there winter and summer. And it's a leisurely life, and I don't have to do anything anymore other than what I want to do. And since I want to, what I spend more time writing, so the books are finished more quickly. I still sit down laboriously and work for 2 hours, hoping to get one page. But out there, I'm now doing that 2 or 3 times a day, so it's going 2 or 3 times more quickly.
Do you ever reread your own books?
I reread it continually until it's published, but I've never been able to read any of my novels after publication the way a reader would read it. After it's published, I'm reading it to see what typographical errors we all overlooked. But I cannot read it the way a reader does because I usually know what's coming, or I regret taking out something that had been taken out.
Let me just ask you one last thing. Why did you want to write? You didn't publish your first novel till you were around 30?
38.
38, okay. Yeah. It's pretty mature for a first novel to come out. You'd worked, I think, in advertising before.
I was working. I continued working for a year after Catch-22 was published.
You'd written short stories before that?
Long before, as a college student, yes.
Why did you want to write?
Why did I want to write? Nobody knows the answer to that. I think if you asked everybody in the country who reads, would you like to write a book? Almost everybody says, I'd love to write a book, and I do have a book. So that wish is kind of general. I mean, there'd be a psychological explanation for the same reason certain people want to act. I think there's a desire to excel and a desire to excel in a way that commands large attention. We use the word fame for it. And writing is a respectable way to become famous.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Well, thanks for being here.
It's been a pleasure. I wish we had another half hour.
Me too. My guest has been writer Joseph Heller, and his books include Catch-22 and Something Happened, Good as Gold. One of his recent books is titled No Laughing Matter, and that's an account of the period when he was paralyzed temporarily due to Guillain-Barré syndrome. His latest book is called God Knows, and his next book, Picture This, is due out in August. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.